This week, the Civil War returned to the headlines when President Trump's chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, praised Confederate General Robert E. Lee in an interview on Fox News. Kelly said that Lee was a man of his times and spoke about the cause of the war.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
Well, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns tweeted out, there's just one thing that caused the Civil War, slavery. Historians weighed in, said there was nothing but compromise from the country's founding through the 1800s up to the war in 1861. Attempts to appease Southern slave-owning states with compromises, while on the other side of this tug of war, lawmakers who passed laws to try to make slavery an issue of states' rights. Let's get a reminder. David Blight is an historian at Yale University who, happily for us, is organizing a conference at Yale this weekend called Disunion in Civil War America: Parallels for Today. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's dive in. Let's go all the way back to the Constitution, which seemed to compromise. It declared slaves three-fifths a person.
Yes, the problem of slavery was compromised as early as the Constitution. There were four or five measures in the Constitution, although the word slavery was never used. That's exactly what they were talking about, the three-fifths compromise. There were other elements, the postponing of the issue of the domestic slave trade for 20 years and others. There was the compromise over Missouri in 1820, which was about the admission of the slave state of Missouri. At the same time, they went out and made Maine into a free state.
Okay, so let's get to 1820. It was actually named the Missouri Compromise, again, allowing Missouri to come into the Union as a slave-owning state.
Right.
But in the process, also forbidding that in other territories. This was the rub, wasn't it, that at this time, it was not about telling the South and slave-owning states they couldn't do that, but looking to future territories and trying to stop it from spreading.
Yes. Slavery was already, by 1820, expanding in leaps and bounds. Because of the cotton boom, it would become even greater in the next decade or two. But there were already northern politicians, in this case, namely Rufus King of New York, who took a stand and others followed him and said, okay, Missouri can enter as a slave state, but we're going to balance it with a free state and make Maine into a state. But then, even more importantly, as you just suggested, they drew a line across the continent at the 3630 parallel and said slavery shall never exist north of that line. Now, that was on the books for the next 34 years until it will be eliminated in the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854.
And some are saying that right there, the idea that there was a compromise allowing the southern states to keep their slave-owning traditions. If the South had stayed with that, who knows what might have happened, accepting that compromise. But as you say, 1854, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, this lets states decide the question of slavery. And this is where, a few years later, Lincoln would come in and say, we can't compromise on this.
Right. Well, it's even preceded by the so-called Great Compromise of 1850, which brought the Southwest into the United States. And it created this idea of popular sovereignty, which was the idea of letting the people vote by referendum in a Western territory about whether they would have slavery or not. It gets then superseded by the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which said the people in a Western territory would indeed determine by vote whether slavery shall exist in the West. It opened up the entire West, and some said even the possibility of northern states now, to the legal spread of slavery. Then we had the Dred Scott case of 1857, which in effect declared that the federal government forever, it said, shall not have the power to deny slaveholders the right of possession and transport of their slaves anywhere in the United States. After the Dred Scott case, there was no middle left anymore in American politics, that there were no compromise measures that would work. And this is where Lincoln does come into the picture, of course. That Republican Party that will eventually elect Lincoln by 1860 takes a firm stand against the expansion of slavery anywhere the federal government had jurisdiction. And that drew a line in the sand that pro-slavery Southerners, most of them Democrats, could not, in their view, tolerate.
Right. Well, and so at this point, we see some of his writing. He's writing to other lawmakers. We will not budge on this. But again, right. He'd been willing, and others had been willing, to allow the southern states to keep it in their area. They refused that compromise. Lincoln then refused to lose the, you know, the restriction on the expansion. And thank goodness he did.
Yes, in retrospect, thank goodness he did. You see, the essential original compromise here, this is what people need to understand, was a compromise with the Constitution itself, which did protect slaveholding as property rights. They were property under the law of slave states. And the Republicans said, we will not bother you where you already own slaves in your own states, but we will stop its expansion in the West. Now, the problem with that idea is that Southerners, pro-slavery Southerners, quite rightly interpreted that the following way. They said to stop or to condemn slavery anywhere is to condemn it everywhere. They believe that if you're condemning slavery in the Western territories and you're saying the American future cannot have slave labor, you're morally condemning it where it already exists. And too many of them who became secessionists said they could not live in the same union with an anti-slavery political coalition that seemed in their view to be on a hell-bent course to destroy their labor system, their economy, their way of life.
Look, your conference this weekend is subtitled Parallels for Today.
What with a question mark.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. So you're not declaring, you're asking.
Well, no, you got to be careful with analogies and parallels. Yeah. We want to keep the question mark in there.
Are there? I mean, you know, some are saying there is, again, no middle ground in the U.S.
Yeah, well, we're running out of a middle. That's true. Well, there are parallels, and this is what we're going to take up in this conference. We're not suggesting that these analogies are direct by any means, but America had a huge problem in the 1850s with nativism, with immigration, had a huge problem with nationalism, pro-slavery nationalism and anti-slavery nationalism. It had a huge issue in defining what is an American. It had a massive problem of race and slavery and trying to define the American future. And perhaps above all to this issue of disunion, it had a political party system tearing itself apart. And this in particular is something we want to look closely at, because the American political party system right now is not in good health. There's all kinds of talk about, you know, where are the third parties? Where are the resistance parties? Where are the anti-Trump Republicans going? And we have a very restricted history of third parties in this country. But the one time in American history when a brand new political party came into existence and then won the presidency within 6 years was the Republican Party of the 1850s. It is the model. It's the story we have to look at to try to understand whether something like that is beginning to happen again.
Well, and it was an anti-slavery party.
It was. Yeah. But it was a party that was a motley coalition, by the way, but it was dedicated to stopping the expansion of slavery into America's future. That sufficiently threatened enough Southerners that they seceded from the Union. And they cast their lot in an attempt to create a separate country,
which
General Kelly called honorable.
Well, you say his words, including talking about the statues as being, you know, reflective of that time. We know most of the Confederate-era statues weren't put up till the early 1900s, and it was about rolling back some of the advances. But you say these words are part of a reconciliationist tradition that absolves everyone of responsibility. What do you mean by that?
Well, General Kelly's comments are rooted in an understanding of American history that was popular essentially in the 1940s and 50s. It's that old. And for two and three generations, historians have exploded it and tried to wash it out of the American consciousness, and we've obviously failed. This is the idea that both sides fought for noble ends. Both sides were honorable in their conscience and in their pursuits, that Southern slaveholders and Southern officers who bolted from the Union were going with their states out of honor rather than their country, as the general just said. And in the end, if you believe this approach, this kind of sentimentalized, romanticized approach to Civil War memory, then nobody's really responsible. And in the end, we don't have to deal with what the war was truly, really about, which was slavery and then the aftermath of the emancipation of 4 million slaves and the redefinition of an American republic.
That's David Blight, historian at Yale University. And again, their conference this weekend is called Disunion in Civil War America, Parallels for Today? We'll link you to more at herenow.org. Professor, to be a fly on that wall, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.